internet was built to be peer-to-peer. Internet was never built to have three corporations in the world to own the entire internet. And if you are a developer, like in Southeast Asia, you want to create a new app that serves hundreds of millions of users. And in India, I was learning that there are more than 1.6 billion people. Imagine that you want to create a super popular application in India, right? That is serving 1 billion people in India. How much you have to spend as a developer, how much you have to beg, how many VCs you have to contact to create an infrastructure, to fund an infrastructure to serve half of the population, just half of the population in India. But with Qt, the way I described it, it can scale to billions of people without any additional cost of infrastructure.
Before starting today's show, I want to mention that starting today, we have partnered with Tangem Wallet, a Swiss-based hardware wallet company. We all have heard the phrase, not your keys, not your coins. It wasn't until FTX and other exchanges collapsed that we understood how important self-custody is for your crypto. That's where hardware wallets come in. Tangem is an amazing hardware wallet that makes storing your crypto super easy with a completely new and secure approach. Tangem is a credit card style wallet with a chip that works with your mobile device. The amazing thing is that the private key is generated on the chip itself. Tangem app itself doesn't store any assets and everything is on the hardware wallet, and it kind of interacts with the app via NFC, which is the same tech as Apple Pay. There are independent audits of the firmware that's conducted by the Swiss auditing companies. If you are interested in grabbing one, you can use my discount code that I will mention in my details of this podcast. Now to the show. Welcome to Biddle Crypto. Today I have Paolo Ordino. He's the CTO of Bitfinex and Tether. He is also the co-founder of Qt.io. I just found out as per crypto Twitter, Paolo is also a certified meme lord. And thanks for coming on Biddle Crypto.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be part of the show and chat a little bit about the technical things. It's of course my passion, so I'm ready.
Wanted to ask you little bit about yourself, how you got interested in this space, and how did you get involved with the crypto space in general?
So I started my journey in the crypto space in 2013, but actually I started my career as a developer, or at least my passion as a developer, since when I was 8 years old. I'm Italian, coming from a small town in Italy, 600 people, not more. And that was, for me, coding, the ability of accessing to computers at a really young age was almost the only way to escape some sort of simple routine that I had in at that point in my life, because living in the farm, my friends were all far, all when you are in a rural area and not necessarily you can ask your parents to drive you every single time of the day to your friend's house. So I was spending a lot of time with myself and with my older brother, but I found in coding a way to escape from the reality that I was living in and trying to build my own reality. Right, I started with as many people and as many developers. I started my career or my first interests were into coding video games. Simple video games in BASIC at first, and then more and more were becoming a little bit more complex. And then I grew up learning more programming languages, C, C++, Java. Then I went to university when I was 18 years old in Genoa, that is in the northwest of Italy, and then graduated in computer science. I started to work as a researcher. I've always been passionate about distributed technologies and peer-to-peer applications, parallel computing and this stuff. So I was hired as a researcher for a military project. So peer-to-peer communications and resilient communications for battlefields in a research facility in Italy. And then, you know, as sometimes happens, especially, I mean, in Italy, but in some countries, the pay was extremely low and, you know, it's kind of sad. And so I decided to look at alternative fields, and I started learning about finance when I was around 19 years old, 20. And then when I was 22, I started to work for an hedge fund in Switzerland that wanted to build a portfolio management system for its clients. And then I moved to London to create my own startup that would provide and build financial services for hedge funds and banks in the city and also in the UK in general. And so I started my journey as a, you know, I would say a hacker mainly, like in a good sense. I like to break things, to learn things and test things and build cool things for myself and in general, put them as open source projects and then look at really complex systems, as I said, you know, even military communications and then move to finance. So I like to think that my journey into crypto then that started in 2013 is sort of a sum of all my previous experiences, both in distributed computing, you know, scalable applications, peer-to-peer, privacy and military projects, and finance. So altogether made me understand Bitcoin, I believe, for what it is. That is, you know, a peer-to-peer cash, electronic cash system. And I almost fell in love immediately with Bitcoin at first sight. First, for the concept of blockchain, super cool. I think is one of the greatest innovations in technology in the last, you know, 30 years. And then at the same time, Bitcoin as a currency. So the powerful currency that could be the internet currency, that is the currency for people. So that's how I arrived into my, you know, into my journey in crypto.
That is wonderful. You know, even I was going to say, I am from a small town, so I can totally relate to what you were talking about. I'm in a small town in India. So you are well-known figure in the crypto sphere, you know, with your associations in Bitfinex and Tether. And I would love to ask you about that, but this particular interview is for Keet, Keet.io, which is your new platform. Can you expand a little bit on what is Keet.io?
Sure. So we are living in a world where, and I know that I'm saying an obvious thing, that something that is that everyone of us are aware of and always are thinking about it, is that we are living in an era where communications are not private anymore, where everything that we say and do and every photo, every content that we produce will finish in a data center owned by a big tech company. Like everyone, almost everyone of us is using either Twitter or Instagram or Gmail, you know, Google Drive, whatever, right? So all these applications have a common denominator factor that is using some centralized data centers. To give an example, we are doing this call on Zoom, and every time when we do a video call or we just do an audio call or we have a chat, every single bit of information that we transmit, right? I'm seeing you and you are seeing me, or I send you a message, you will receive my message. Every single bit of information that we share with each other is traveling thousands of miles to reach the other party, but it's traveling. In our specific case, you mentioned that you are, I think, now living in India. I'm in this moment in Switzerland, and of course, our message is traveling thousands of miles. But imagine if you know you have friends in India. I have friends in Italy. Or like friends in Switzerland, right? So most of the people, 90% of the people, are actually talking and interacting with people in their own city, right, in their own area. So now we are now living in a world that, as I said, where people are feeling more and more comfortable in sharing information about themselves to their family, friends. But also the most creepy part is that while they're sharing information with their family and friends, they are sharing information with data centers, with big tech companies. So every time we produce any content, it will be owned, will be stored online outside of our control. And that is, and again, an obvious thing to say, right? We are all aware of that problem. So, but we have also to think about the fact that these big tech companies are craving, are desperate for our data, fresh data daily, because without that, they will not be able to sustain the cost of those data centers, because they are taking our data and they are reselling it to other parties to make money out of it, to pay for the services, to keep adding more servers, to eat more data, to sell more data, and so on and so forth, right? This is a never-ending machine. And the more, you know, we are always pushed by big tech companies to provide more data, because if we stop, if humanity would stop to giving them data for a few days, few weeks, they cannot resell this new data, and so they cannot make money, and everything will fall down. It's like a castle of cards, because if you have a pharmaceutical company that is buying data from a big tech company, or you know, or like an e-commerce platform is trying to, you know, advertise your products that you might be interested because you did a search on a search engine, that data has to be contextual to a particular moment in time. You cannot take or get data that is 1 year old, because that will not be meaningful anymore. So bottom line, we are producing data daily. The data is stored on privately owned data centers and is harvested by big tech companies and resold. Now, these big tech companies trying to make us believe that cloud is our friend, right? That all this process where we give up control of our own data is something that is normal, is something that, you know, is good process, because they are keeping good care of our data, because they are storing our data for us, because, you know, we cannot be trusted to store our own data. We don't know how to do it. They know how to do it, right? They can do it much better than us. So, you know, we are pushed in trusting them, right? These clouds have, you know, really cool names, and you know, they have plenty of tools. And so again, more and more also our business data finishes on these clouds. With the reason why this is happening is also because there is no alternative, right? So because there is the concept that if you need to interact with someone, you are pushed to think that you need an infrastructure, something in the middle between you and the other person. Let's say that you have a friend that is sitting in the same city, right, where you are living now, right? Maybe this friend is 2 kilometers from you. And then you send to him a message on WhatsApp, right? It's really likely that when you send a message or do a video call with your friend, all the packets, all the information that you are sending to him is traveling, even if you are only 2 kilometers away. That information will travel thousands of miles to the data center of WhatsApp and then go back to your friend. So instead of doing 2 kilometers, is doing 5,000 miles, right? So, or 5,000 kilometers. I'm, for example, you know, I have family in Italy. I'm in Switzerland. That is a little bit northern than Italy. And so if I want to send a message to my family in Italy, I send a message on WhatsApp. That message, instead of going south to the nearby phone cell and to, you know, to the most nearby switches, routers, and arrive to my family, will go north to Frankfurt and then south to Italy, right? Again, to the WhatsApp, to the most nearby WhatsApp data center. That is not sustainable. So it means that when we do a video call, every single piece, bit of that video call will travel thousands of miles to get to a nearby data center that anyway is thousands of miles away, just to get back to, you know, that just to get back to our friend that is living maybe, or our family member, or our business partner that is living nearby us, right? Imagine how much waste we are producing in terms of waste on the internet grid. So all the countries are putting a ton of money in investing in expanding the internet grid, adding more switches, adding more backbones, adding more fibers, because all the data that we produce have to go on, travel thousands of miles, and then get distributed just maybe nearby to us. Because it's known, is a statistic, that more than 85% of the people are talking for the majority of their time either via phone or via WhatsApp or via Telegram or, you know, WeChat, whatever, or exchanging information in a way, pictures, with people that are living within 100 kilometers from their homes. And yet, you know, the every single bit of information is doing 50 times to 500 times the length in order to arrive to destination. That doesn't make any sense. So that's what I really don't like. The problem is twofold. We are pushed to store information on someone else's infrastructure just so they can make money out of it. And plus, we are lied to, because these big tech companies are lying to us, because they're telling us the only way to communicate with each other is passing through their data centers. So that they do that because then they can see all our information. So I've been in the around the tech industry for a long time, and I happen to have a good understanding of the file sharing applications history. You surely remember that Napster was the first one.
Definitely.
And after Napster, Napster was shut down. So then people said, okay, you know, we cannot have one single server, one single company. That is too risky, right? Because if you have only one, it's a single point of failure. So let's create another system. And then GNUtella, LimeWire were created. But they had, instead of one server, they were using a few hundred servers. And then they were shut down as well, right? So because, you know, it worked for a few years and then were shut down. And then a solution came up that was BitTorrent. BitTorrent had basically two innovations. So because before BitTorrent, there was eDonkey that had centralized servers for indexing and for indexers, so to have a list of all the files, but then people could share these files between themselves peer-to-peer. But also that created problems, because the indexers now were the ones that were under the radar under scrutiny, sorry. And so BitTorrent created a huge innovation. It unifies two things: DHTs, so distributed hash tables, that are basically databases that can be split in millions of parts and stored in each one of the different computers that are participating to the network, and also peer-to-peer communication, so called hole punching. Hole punching is a technique that allows two computer, two devices to talk to each other without passing through a central server. And so BitTorrent suddenly created a system that had 10 million nodes or 20 million nodes that were all the computers of each one of us that were connected, you know, that were sharing files with each other. And so all these computers were creating this network that was, you know, accounting for 10 millions and millions of nodes. Each computer was a node, and basically was storing a little bit of information of these huge indexes, right? So the database where you could find who had a specific movie or has a specific file was stored in this distributed hash table, and each part, the distributed hash table, each node, so each computer, each device of a person would keep a small portion of it. So now, you know, BitTorrent created a system where when the survival of the system was not only sustained by 100 people or 100 computers, was split across 10 million computers. And who wanted to attack this system could attack 100 computers or 100 systems, but could not attack 10 million of them, right? It's too much. So BitTorrent created the first super resilient network for file sharing. And so a few years ago, myself and Matthias Buz, that is the CEO of Holepunch, got to know each other. And we share the same passion, same vision, and same passion for BitTorrent as a technology. But we thought that BitTorrent was limited because BitTorrent was only used for file sharing. But what if we could reuse the same technology, but using it for real-time communications? So real-time phone communications could be video calls, audio calls, chats, still file transfer, that's great. But also, you know, sharing trading signals, whatever, right? So whatever you are doing in your life, or sharing like traffic stats, real-time traffic information is all real-time feeds, real-time information. So BitTorrent protocol could do much more than just file transfers, could serve real-time streams. And so in this world, everything from a video call, a chat, everything is a real-time stream or could be manipulated to be a real-time stream. And so that's how Holepunch and Kit started. We wanted to create or leverage the BitTorrent protocols to use them to create the first real-time experience with video chat, voice calls, text chat, file sharing that didn't have any single point of failure, any single centralized infrastructure that could be shut down. And so the beauty then of this technology that allows two phones or two devices, one phone, one computer, whatever, to interact directly with each other. So now, if I want to talk with my family that is, 50 kilometers living 50 kilometers from myself, the message that I send to them or the voice call that I do with them is just traveling 50 kilometers and not 5,000 plus 50 kilometers, right? That is an unprecedented, groundbreaking innovation that, by the way, is not an innovation in the sense that this technology was already out there. The innovation was, in fact, the fact that we took an existing technology and we reproposed it for something that where all the competitors have always been centralized. And the reason why we can do it is because, luckily Bitfinex and Tether are two companies that really believe and share the vision of the decentralization of Bitcoin and crypto and so on. And so we are, as companies, we are always reinvesting in open technology. In technologies, we believe that people should be able to communicate freely, to communicate openly. They should allow to have their own privacy and so on. So we wanted to, even if we are not making money of it, because the thing is that if you don't have control over people's data, you cannot make money out of it, right? It's simple as that. But we wanted to dedicate part of our profits with the other companies to create something that could be a gift for everyone.
That is beautiful. That was my next question or one of my questions on the business model. So you kind of answered that. And so it's great to know from you that the vision of peer-to-peer messaging, where file sharing with BitTorrent, where it left off, you guys are, wanted to build much more than that. And your reasons around why that is important, owning your data. It's now very prudent that we have these sorts of technologies, especially country like India also, where privacy wasn't the default kind of psychology in when I was growing up here. We didn't have sci-fi novels like Neuromancers and all those exposures to sci-fi growing up. And now people in India are also getting aware of their privacy and the challenges around that. It's fantastic. My question to you is regarding, I'll go, would like you to go more into detail of what some of the features, Keet, how it differentiates itself from some of the privacy preserving app out there like Signal, which I believe might not be a pure peer-to-peer play, and correct me if I'm wrong. And this seems like to me extension of Skype, but with much more functionality and you know other sort of aspects to it. So it would be great if you could elaborate a bit on if the data is not stored between the two parties, it is end-to-end encrypted, and the routing that happens, as you mentioned, you know, it doesn't route to the servers because there is no servers. This is you're running your own software on your node, on your laptop. How does it route? Also, like suppose if my if I am not running my system 24/7, does it route through like in case of real-time applications, right? How does that happen?
Right, there's a lot to unpack there. So I think the first thing that you mentioned is Skype, and I think is a great point to confirm the point of view that I was making before. Skype started as a peer-to-peer communication company, but then was bought by Microsoft, and suddenly right. The peer-to-peer part disappeared.
Went away.
And, yes. Why? It's not because it was not working properly. The reason is that it's more profitable to keep control over all of the data, right? And again, that's my point. So Keet has, first of all, is end-to-end encrypted. The way it works is simple, well, kind of simple. So every device generates a private and public key, right? The private key is stored on the device, and the public key is the way is used to allow others to find you. How they find you, right? So with your public key, you can publish your public key on the DHT. Remember when we were talking about BitTorrent? So BitTorrent was storing basically part of the indexes, part of the reference to the files that you could find on BitTorrent on the DHT, right? So in order for having this gigantic network, being able to store small portions of small bits of the indexes, the same thing happened here, right? So your public key or the way people can find you is stored in the DHT. So basically the DHT nodes have a relationship between the public key and the routing to your device. Could be directly your IP address, could be your VPN, whatever. Right. So the DHT nodes can store in a relationship between your public key and a routing path to you. Right. So when, for example, I start Keet, I have my private key and the public key. You start Keet, you have your private key and your public key. So, for example, I create a room that is a Keet room, and I store basically when I create a Keet room, I store the information of the also the Keet room has a public and private key. So the Keet room, the information of the Keet room, the public key, will be stored on the DHT alongside with information to reach me because I'm the other peer in the room. So I share with you the link to the room. You can query the DHT, of course, with the signature. So in order to invite you, I had to co-sign the fact, cryptographically sign the fact that I wanted to invite you. So you take the link. From the link, you can derive the link contains some cryptographic information. So it contains the information that you can verify on the DHT, my public key, and also you will tell the DHT node. So since you have the invite will attest that I'm okay with sharing the routing information to you, my routing information to you. So basically, when your Keet instance will query the DHT through the link, the link will tell the DHT node, share the routing information, and allow this person into the room that that Paolo created. And so basically at that point, you have my routing information. So basically, for example, could be my VPN, could be my APM port directly, and you can connect to me directly. But you know, you can expect that everyone in this world is running is or having firewalls, and so the port, my port, might not be open, right? So, and that's how 99% of the time happened. So this enter in play a protocol called hole punching. Hole punching is a solution that allows two devices behind firewalls to connect, to open a direct connection to each other without passing through a central server. So hole punching basically works in this way, is using the UDP protocol and allows this. So two devices are contacting the DHT node. The DHT node basically tells or trying to or suggest a port, an UDP port, where the two of our the two devices should communicate or trying to agree on. So for example, I start the connection to your IP address and to an UDP port. And that connection will fail because your firewall will say no, or that port will be closed, or your firewall will say no. But then at the same time, you know, around the same time, you start a connection from your device to my IP address and port. And that fails. But the second time, what will happen when these two connections will fail is that at the same time, when we do this attempt, in our NAT table, there will be stored the attempt. And the so on your side, you will see that there is a failed connection that came from my IP address to your internal UDP port, and I will see the same on mine. But in a way, it is going to be considered something legitimate. So the next time we try in the NAT table, there is already that information. And so there is already the confirmation that it was an attempt that we wanted to connect. And so the second time we try will happen. So basically the first time it fails because there is no prior knowledge of the willingness of opening a connection between two devices. But when we try again, that will go through because the NAT table will be has been already refreshed and informed about our interest to open a connection. And of course, it can only happen if I do the same connection from my IP address to you, and the same thing from you to me, almost at the same time on the ports that were pre-agreed through the DHT node. And so then, boom, we can have a direct connection between our two devices. And of course, since there is a public and private key, you know, I have to co-sign with my private key a message to you so that you can verify that it's me connecting to you, it's not a random person connecting to you. I hope that was clear.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for that detail. That's wonderful. You know, while you were speaking, I had a question that in connecting to peers, is there exposure of your IP address in some way? Is that taken care of in some way? You know, in BitTorrent, you could like see your peers and stuff, like even in, you know, this application Chia that I interviewed, Bram Cohen, creator of BitTorrent, we can kind of observe like their IP addresses and stuff. So is there any provisions for in order to like encapsulate or hide that, obfuscate that? And secondly, with that kind of peer-to-peer connection, do you think maybe I'm thinking a little bit far out, but ISPs could still eavesdrop on such sort of communication?
Right. So first of all, the IP address, your IP address, could be exposed. That's why, but the hole punching works through VPNs as well. So basically, if you have a VPN, you can only the last IP address will be potentially known to the other party. And so that is the good part and the downside of this technology. That if you, you know, depends on how you want to protect yourself, but and how, you know, what you want to do. But I think, is it better if Google knows your IP address or if your, you know, friend knows your IP address? I believe that most of the time you would trust more your friend than Google.
100%. Yeah.
And anyway, you can use VPNs and other techniques to hide your IP address, right? So there is no problem with that. Then secondly, all the data that is exchanged is fully encrypted. So there is no way, even if someone sees the traffic, there is no way to catch anything out of the traffic because no metadata is leaked from the conversation. So there is no way to attack it. And you mentioned also Signal. The issue with Signal is a great product. But the issue with Signal is that if someone wanted to take out Signal, they could just, you know, DDoS the servers and keep doing that. And Signal would go offline until the DDoS stops. With this, instead, with this system, there's no way to DDoS it because, you know, every node is by itself, right? Every node acts independently. It's like BitTorrent. There's no way to DDoS BitTorrent. And so that's the thing that I like the most, because we have seen in countries, certain countries, they like to ban IP addresses of communication services. Like in some countries, WhatsApp is banned, or in other countries, Telegram is banned, and so on, just because they use centralized infrastructures. With Qt, you cannot do that because everyone is using its own IP address to communicate with each other.
Yes, that's the wonderful aspect of Qt, and that's what I'm kind of recognizing, that how wonderful that is. It's creating this mesh network, like an alternative internet, which now was envisioned in the past. Also, I was reading David Clark's book, you know, David Clark, one of the chief architects of the internet. And, you know, he had mentioned their technologists were not in charge of technology when they were launching the internet. And, you know, they had privacy in mind, but because of, you know, rushing these things, you know, we had DNS and all that weaknesses around the internet. So there's a wonderful thing that a wonderful mission that you're on. Switching gears, I think you did mention about the tech stack that Qt is built on. So I think that's quite detailed. Anything that's like, so you mentioned JavaScript, like, you know, India has a lot of JavaScript developers. So is there like development also happening in Qt? Like where is it at launch? I think I downloaded the app and I see it's in alpha right now, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yes. So in the next 2 to 3 weeks, we are going to release the beta for mobile. It's going to be 100 times better. So we spent the last 8 months to work on the product, and also added a feature that answers to one of the questions that you had before. So here's the issue with peer-to-peer, right? Imagine that I have my Qt application on my phone. You have your Qt application on your phone. We create a room. And then you are offline. I send a message to you in the room, and then I go offline. Then you come online and usually wouldn't see anything. That is the issue with peer-to-peer, right? Because if there is no central infrastructure, you know, if I'm not online, you know, how you get my data, right? The data cannot stay in the ether. The data has to stay somewhere. So what we came up with is a really neat feature. Is called blind mirroring. And so the more people you have in Qt, you can use your friends to store encrypted payload so that when you are offline, your friends can relay the data on your behalf, right? So, and each one will be able to decide how much they want to help you and so on and so forth. But so even if you are going offline, there is someone that you trust already anyway that can basically do a relay of your traffic until you come online.
I had a question regarding that. So is it, so the relay, that's very interesting. I want to know more. So can you pick that, or is it randomly assigned? Can be done both ways?
It can be done both ways, right? So it's also part of the user experience. Of course, we will have a list of the most active friends, like the ones that are more online, because you want to have a certain guarantee that your data will have can be mirrored in a blinded form with more reliability. But also, so you can pick your friends, or you can allow the app to do it for you. And that is extremely resilient, again, because if we were having centralized infrastructure to act as blind relay, then it will not solve the problem. That infrastructure could be targeted. But instead, if everyone has different friends, right? So everyone will rely on different people to store partial parts of the information. And so you create a network effect that I believe it will be unprecedented.
Okay, so I can imagine a scenario or a use case where, say, I know I want to travel and these are some of my friends who are mostly online. They're not traveling. And I can, with the push of a button, say, hey, you know what? In case this message doesn't go through, it routes through one of like this group of friends that I have and eventually reaches its destination, right? So once I push it.
You can do that. Or you can also run your Raspberry Pi at home and have that as your blind relay.
Oh, yeah, that too. Wonderful. Yeah, that is exciting. That's pretty exciting, actually. Because that's a differentiating factor, actually, I see that you guys have in terms of, you know, reeling that information. And, you know, in India, we have a lot of issues. Sometimes there's issues with electricity in smaller towns that we have. The internet goes down a bunch of times. So it will be ideal to be able to, you know, message while, you know, some of your friends are offline or you're offline. On that, you know, I want to piggyback on that and ask you, how do you envision the future of, I know there are new iterations coming out as we speak. What do you envision Keet to be and what sort of use cases will it enable?
So before you mentioned JavaScript, and so Keet for the most part is written in JavaScript, and we'll also have a plugin system that will be available in JavaScript. The reason is that we want, and also all the, if you look at the whole bunch of libraries that are powering Keet, they are open source, and they are all written in JavaScript. The reason is that JavaScript is the most used programming language in the world, right? So it's used by web developers, and you can find any web developer could actually learn really quickly how Holepunch works and how Keet works.
So is it with JavaScript, is it both front-end, back-end, like Node.js, back-end, and front-end, say, React or something like that, right?
We have React for front-end, React Native for the mobile part, and the back-end is written in JavaScript and a little bit of C for the most important and core parts. But most of the people, so if you write a plugin, has to be, you know, it will interact only with the front end. So we will have some hooks in the UI so that you can create your plugin that change the behavior, add features, and so on and so forth. And we want to transform, and also another thing that I probably never mentioned to anyone else that is coming along really well, is that we are rolling out our own runtime that will be a competitor on Node.js. Because it's a runtime that will be built for peer-to-peer applications. Instead, so it will allow anyone to build a really simple Keet or any simple like application where devices have to interact will be really simple with this runtime. Will be still JavaScript-based, so you can write JavaScript stuff and it will work. But we'll have all the primitives, all the peer-to-peer primitives to create simple and complex peer-to-peer applications. And it's so lightweight, we can also work and run on embedded systems. So we want to open source all that part because we believe that everyone, every web developer should transform himself or herself into be a peer-to-peer developer. Because suddenly, you know, one of the things that makes me more annoyed is that if you are a developer today and you have a great idea, most of the time, in order to make that idea real, you have to work with, you have to contact a VC, you have to try to get funding, and most of your funding will be spent in infrastructure. Because you have to buy servers, because if your idea is successful, you'll have billions of people or millions of people anyway using your idea. And so you'll need a lot of infrastructure. But now with peer-to-peer, you can contact and reach or allow applications to be used by millions of people without the need to spend millions of dollars in centralized infrastructure. So suddenly, every single web developer can start building applications that could be Keet clones or could be, you know, other, like, you know, could be good games online, for example, without any single bit of infrastructure. all fully peer-to-peer. And so that, again, is unprecedented. I think that all punch and Kita's technologies are opening the doors to a new wave of developers that can build awesome user experiences without having to worry about trying to beg for venture capitalists for a little bit of funding.
Oh, that is very powerful, what you just mentioned. I think it can totally change the game. And I'm wondering, there will be extensions built on Keat too, so you can have all sorts of like games and you know, all sort of applications that are developing on Keat to build that environment out. So that's fantastic. I believe some aspects of concurrency will be handled. Like how would that at the foundational level concurrency is handled? Is it typically how Node handles it, or there is like any kind of Rust implementation, or like you know, if you can elaborate a bit on the on the,
So well, for the JavaScript part, we use still the V8 virtual machine. So because you don't want to reinvent the wheel, and V8 is pretty much the standard. But at the core level, so all the networking part is written in C, and so all the complex parts are built in C. So you get, you can get multi-threading on the C part, like managing connections and so on. And so that is helpful to get a real-time experience and have good level of concurrency when it comes to all the basically the core part, and everything else will be anyway super optimized. So definitely will be faster and more scalable than Node. I consider myself at least a fairly good Node developer, and concurrency in with Node is terrible, right? So okay, you have worker threads, but it's it kind of sucks because you can only do message passing between worker threads, and they are copied. The data is actually copied, so duplicated, and instead of being actually just the memory being passed, right? So in our case, we are trying to encapsulate all the core and more CPU intensive processes in C, so that we can leverage the multi-threading part, but also for the JavaScript part, have the we will still use the V8.
What is your message to folks who are like the budding developers in Southeast Asia, countries like India? I mean, there are a lot of JavaScript developers here, React, Java, all those sorts of guys. Why should they? What is your message to them in terms of why built on Keat?
So my message to developers is that I'm a developer since now 30 years, and internet was built to be peer to peer. Internet was never built to have three corporations in the world to own the entire internet, right? You have Google, Amazon, and Microsoft that now account for 60%, 70% of the storage of this and server space. That's not the future that we want. That's not the future that we should build. The future that we should build is taking control again over our information and also over the user experience. So with Holepunch and Keat, so with Holepunch libraries and Keat, we are demonstrating that you can get user experiences that are much better than what we're used to with centralized applications, and but at the fraction of the cost. You know that Telegram costs I think a few hundred million dollars per year of infrastructure, and because it has 800 million users. And if you are a developer, like in Southeast Asia, you want to create a new app that serves hundreds of millions of users. And in India, I was learning that there are more than 1.6 billion people. Imagine that you want to create a super popular application in India, right? That is serving 1 billion people in India. How much you have to spend as a developer, how much you have to beg, how many VCs you have to contact to create an infrastructure, to fund an infrastructure to serve half of the population, just half of the population in India. Imagine how complex is that. And so you have to be a developer, you have to be a businessman, you have to be a marketing guru and so on, because you have to to do it everything to trying to raise hundreds of millions of dollars, right? I mean, it's extremely complex. And just to test, or, you know, just to put out your application and have your application being used by hundreds of millions of people. But with Qt, the way I described it, it can scale to billions of people without any additional cost of infrastructure. And so if we are demonstrating that with Qt, everyone can do it with all the other applications. You can do a peer-to-peer, you know, Uber. You can do a peer-to-peer Airbnb. All this stuff can become peer-to-peer. There will be no infrastructure costs. And so every single guy with his or girl with his laptop in his room, on his dormitory, can build crazy applications without going around and begging for money. I think that is the biggest and most important sense of freedom that you will feel starting to use this technology. And I don't earn anything. There is no way for us to monetize Qt, Holepunch. There is no way, right? Because it's peer-to-peer. There is no central point of control. So I don't cannot make money. So I don't want to sell anything here to anyone. It's just that the way we built this thing from the point of view of developers that want to build great applications, but they don't need and don't want to spend their time in trying to find funding and giving up pieces of their companies or their ideas to someone just to trying to raise a few million dollars to put a project out there. You can do it everything from your home, from your laptop, with Holepunch and Qt.
That is amazing. That's a wonderful answer. Paolo, where can my listeners learn more about Qt, reach out to you or your team or anybody and, you know, join the revolution?
So you should go on Qt.io, Qeet.io. There you will find all the resources. You'll find also another website called holepunch.to. That is where all the documentation, technical documentation, is being provided. And the links of all the open, strongly recommend to start from there. Just Qeet.io. You'll not regret it.
Sounds good. Thank you. I would love to have you again in the future. And best wishes for Qeet.io. I myself is intrigued to use it and give you feedback about it. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.